think that that should be sort of a, somehow we should not be fed by other ages, other cultures, other minds, other spirits. Well, it's counter to the whole Christian tradition of tradition, which is handing down something that is of value from one period, from one age to the next. If we're going to be so existential in our thinking that we think like Sartre, that we have to start from nothingness and live in that state of nothingness until we make a decision, as if that were possible even, because we still have to deal with language, which is a traditional thing, which is handed to us. There's no one, absolutely no one, who can live in this absolute independence of that which has gone before. And to assume that we have a non-historical kind of life is of all things, I think, the most stupid. But that, I think, has a lot to do with the dropping out of many of the traditional, traditionally classical subjects in education in high school. And I don't think this is a democratic way to educate people. In Europe, where they certainly stop very early on in an educational life and say, now you have to decide whether you're going to be a technical person or a person that's going into university life, or if you're going to go into some kind of professional work such as medicine or engineering, or if you're going to not go on at all and maybe you're going to go into do the kind of work that is most natural to you in farming or so on, because that's where you've been living. Whatever it is, I mean, they have to make that decision fairly early. But we discovered when we lived there the first year we were married in 39 and 40, that the man who was the Wachtmeister, the custodian of our big apartment building in Oslo, could argue circles around Carol on the monetary system, the world monetary system. And he hadn't gone very far in schooling in terms of what we would say would be the kind of advanced schooling, and yet he had had enough in his background in his beginning schooling so that he had enough he could discuss with a great deal of knowledge and with not a little bit of historical knowledge as well, the problem of the whole economic setup in the world today. And this was simply because he had a very fundamental kind of teaching from his teachers in the Norwegian graded school system, which included a wider range by far than anything we have. Now I'm not like Howard Hung. I don't look at the Scandinavians and say, if we could be only like them. I mean, I don't have any illusions like that. I don't want any children of mine, wouldn't want any of them to grow up there and think that that was going to be the answer. But I do decry the lack of nourishment that I think the average high school student today is deprived of in his schooling. I think it's going to be warm in here if we don't have a door open. Carol, do you want to open the door into the hall? Not because I think it's no. I think the hall door. That might be too much of a draft on you there, John. But I think that's got to be open wide. Yeah. Because it's and maybe if this maybe Carol, can you open the top? Is the upper half of this door? Yeah. Don't open the bottom half, or the girls will fall through. Okay. Because it gets hot, and I must say that, you know, when you discuss something like images and stuff like that, I can't have you all going to sleep on me. I don't need an image of that. It's a living image of boredom. So, but but the reason that we're, the reason that I'm taking the time to explain this is that, that you may think, what has somebody that we have to read in translation, like Dante, who wrote in Italian, why is he important for our understanding of our relationship with these people who wrote some of the most outstanding works in terms of Christian imagination, that the group of people that we know as the Inklings. And it isn't just the Inklings who were affected by Dante, but they are the people that we are thinking about in particular in these next 3-4 days. I think when I talk about the way in which Dante's work develops and give you some examples of the kind of writing it is, I think you'll see why he had such an impact on these writers and why we get him in a diluted form in the Narnia series, for example, or in the Charles Williams novels, or in not in the Tolkien books in terms of actual images, because Tolkien was much more influenced by the Old Norse and the Icelandic and the Beowulf myth and so on than he was by the Dante figures. But still, the whole understanding of imagery was very real to him in terms of this medieval tradition. So it's not so far removed from your own reading that we pick up somebody like Dante and take a little time with him in order to give you just a taste of what he's like. And maybe, like as it happened last year when we talked about him, and maybe I did a better sales pitch on him that time, I don't know how it can be this year, but you know, you can't always tell until it happens whether or not you're going to have any results on your selling. But just about everybody in the group that when we discussed particularly the Inferno decided that they were going to buy a copy of the Inferno if they could get a hold of it, and really got excited about reading it because they realized it was not just a quote classic on the shelf. And as I told you last fall when I talked about Sartre and his concern about the freedom and responsibility of reading a book, this is also true of any kind of reading that you do, even with something like a classic. The minute you take it off the shelf and open it, you have a responsibility to use these heads of yours to concentrate on it and find out what it is about. We did discuss, I think last fall, the Christian imagination and the reason why we have a right to use the term Christian in connection with the imagination. I hate the word Christian used glibly and casually as an adjective, but you know, there's some things you can't just fight all the time for meanings of words and positions of words and whether they should be adjectives or nouns. And if you're going to listen to Carol Hinderly, why, and I don't mean Carol Lenderly, I mean Carol Hinderly, you know, you can't use the word Christian about yourself either, because he insists that the last Christian died on the cross. So we do have to understand adjectives in terms of the way they have been used. And the Christian imagination is a term we use as a common one amongst ourselves, and so I think we don't have to explain it and defend it. But we did discuss this, and we talked about the fact that images and the imagination are not something that should be difficult for you and I to understand, because when we understand Christian doctrine, we understand we are created imago Dei. Now that's a Latin word for the image of God. We are created in the image of God. Now that means that you and I, in a sense, are images. Now does that mean that we're an image such as, I don't have one up here, such as, you know, like an idol would be, or an image or a bust of Shakespeare or an image of the Virgin Mary or something like that. This is not what we mean by images. And if we're going to say that, then an image of God would simply be a something that we fixed to a wall or had sitting here, and it had no life of its own. An image, you must understand, has a life of its own. This is the remarkable thing about understanding this term. And you have to understand this term if you're going to understand imagination, but you also have to understand it if you're going to understand any of the works of Dante or most of the works of any of the great writers, and certainly the works of Lewis and of Charles Williams. The meaning of the term image is what we are going to discuss today, and why I am concerned about our being just a small group involved in this particular discussion, because it's not something that everybody is necessarily going to have to be involved in. But I think that if you consider yourself at all knowledgeable in any kind of literary field, if you're going to understand the writing of imaginative writers, you have to understand the way in which images are explained and what they mean. There are several important things about images that we're going to come to as we discuss it. But I wanted to mention first this idea of being the image of God. What do we have as the image of God in our makeup? What is the thing that you'd think of right away? What do we have?
Well, we have the ability to distinguish between right and wrong.
All right, we've got a... We can distinguish between right and wrong, and what do we have when we distinguish? Anybody else? What else do you have when you distinguish between right and wrong? What do you do about it?
You have a choice.
Sure, you have a choice. What do we call that?
Well, free will.
Free will? Yeah, free will. You can say it loudly. That's right.
With a very tentative free will, but
free will is what you have. You know, an image has free will. All right, then, image is not just a plaster cast. It's not a duplication. And this is what we think about an image. You know, we always think about an image as being something, it's an identical thing with, the image of his parents. It's impossible. Nobody. If that's the way you mean it, then it's sort of like you have a pattern and you make it and you say, like a stencil. It's not a stencil. You're not a mimeograph. That's not an image. An image has the quality of independence, of life, of movement, of choice within it. And if we're in the image of God, the way he created us was with this kind of freedom. Now, there are a lot of people who refuse this understanding of their life as an image of God. They really throw it off because they say the way they live actually, legalistically, is that they have no choice. Their choices have been made for them. And so they are able to live very unrisky lives. You know, the fences are there, the road is there, and, you know, you don't have any choices to make anymore. But if you really understand the meaning of image, you know that life is a continual series of choices. And this you'll find to be absolutely consistent with the way in which an image is used in the literature, particularly of these people that we're talking about today. Now, I think we need to understand that that anything that you and I say to each other is a symbol of what we mean. In other words, we all know that language itself is a series of symbols because of the fact that how do I know that when I talk to Laura that she is going to know what I mean? I mean, she I'm saying something to her. Inside me, I'm not the same as Laura. We're two images created with free will, free choices, different histories, different backgrounds. How can we understand each other? All right, now what do we use to relate? Language. And language is agreed on symbols. They're agreed, they're things that we've thrown together, which is really what the word means. They've been thrown together so that we agree on this means this. This means this, the word we use is table. Okay, this is a table. If we're going to be explicit, it's a desk. But this is, it's not it. Is it what it is? Desk? Does that say what it is? Table? Does that say what it is? No, it just simply is a symbol for what you and I know to be this particular thing. Does that say it? You see what a really difficult problem you're involved with when you try to understand how did we manage ever to communicate? Well, symbols are not just language. There are a lot of symbols that we use in daily life everywhere that we take for granted. Now, one of the, Charles Williams has an excellent kind of rundown on the way in which symbols and imagery is developed. And the reason he does this is because for him, the way of images is an important part of his understanding of God and man. It isn't just a literary thing. This is deep in the whole theology of the person and his relationship with God in grace. And because of this, he feels language and its understanding is crucial. And so we do have to take time to explain what we mean. And if it seems for some of you that this is rather ABC and elementary, you'll just have to be patient and realize that there are some people who may not know about that, and you may know a lot more about it. But it doesn't hurt to have things overlearned, as you realize when you learn a language, that the more you repeat something, the more you repeat it, the more you know it, you finally begin to dream in it, and then you know that you're beginning to know it. But you don't do that until you really overlearn something. Well, this is also true of having to have things repeated, which may be very well known to you even now. This is simply by way of saying that we do have to go back over certain elementary things. John, did you do a session on images how the difference between symbol, arbitrary symbol, and so on?
No, we didn't.
Okay,
it's in one of the essays that was recommended, but we didn't do it.
All right. Well, I just wanted to be sure that I wasn't overdoing too much repeating too much. And
Langer's Prince of Creation.
Would one of you, John or Carol, would you get me a drink of water? Oh, good. That lady in the kitchen. That's good. I'm going to explain to you first what we understand as an arbitrary symbol. How many of you remember mathematics or arithmetic? You did take arithmetic, didn't you? All right. Now, what is the symbol that we use for addition? Do they still use that? I don't know about new math.
Yeah, cross.
Yes, it's a cross, isn't it? Now, is there any reason why? I mean, does that make sense? I mean, why does this kind of a symbol, why does that mean plus? Is there anything that reminds you of plus in this? It's absolutely crazy. Cockeyed. You know? But you know, mathematicians, they're the smart ones. They're the logical ones. But you know, they hit on all these little symbols, and you take them. And because you respect them, believe me, you know you don't When you see that sign, you know that means plus, even if it doesn't make any sense. Now, that's what we call an arbitrary symbol. It's something you learn. It's just like saying desk, you know, this is a desk. Well, unless you know a long ways back in the history of the language, you wouldn't know why you used the word desk, but you've learned it. In a sense, a lot of language is arbitrary symbol for most of us, because of the fact that for us, we don't know linguistics and the backgrounds of semantics so that we know why things developed the way they did. And our understanding of changes in language are sort of, we really can't take time for all that. But so we do accept certain things as arbitrary symbols. They've been fixed. Most of language symbols, however, do have reason behind them, if you go back far enough. Where the mathematical reasoning for this, for this particular symbol comes from, I don't know. I really have wondered about it and wondered why they picked on it. Perhaps there's a reason in some other language for it, for the plus symbol. But anyway, that's an arbitrary symbol. Now then, we have natural symbols. What about, how many of you have, well, of course you have, you know, in any kind of a, if you drive down a road, how about if you're going to come to two roads that are crossing each other? What symbol could be used for that?
Plus sign.
A crossroad. Now, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got a road going here, you've got a road crossing it. I mean, that's a crossroad, right? Okay. That's that. If you saw that and you didn't understand any English, you could figure out there's going to be a crossing there. That's a crossroads. Okay. That's a natural symbol. That's a symbol that makes sense to us because it has a natural relationship. Now then. Suppose you take that symbol one more jump and say, what do we say when we say we're at the point of a decision? When you say, I've got to make up my mind about this. You know, I'm sort of...
At the crossroads?
Yeah, you're at a crossroads. See what I mean? I mean, the symbol can go beyond. We're out of the world of plus. Plus hasn't got anything to do with this. This is the arbitrary symbol is out of it. But the minute you get into natural symbol, then you can move from what is a crossroads physically, also can become a crossroads internally. That is, it can become a personal, natural kind of decision that you have to make. So you can jump into that. And a natural symbol can be used for that. It works. All right. Now, what about a cross used for something else? We just went through Easter. What did we talk about? A lot. Be brave.
Which one?
A cross. Right. A cross. Yeah, and that's this way too, isn't it? Okay, now you can say, yeah, but that's something else again, because the reason we talk about the cross is that that was an instrument of torture, and it happened to be made like this, and that's why we use the cross. Uh-huh, but if you've ever listened to any carefully worked out meditations on the cross, you know that there are many, many ways in which people can use that symbol. One line goes vertical, one line goes horizontal. Christ is at the center of the horizontal and the vertical. Ha, that's the cross, you see. There's a lot of meaning in that symbol. It also means that as we look up, we are related to God. As we look across, we're related to our neighbor. It's the cross. It's also the crossroads as far as the whole destiny of the cosmos was concerned. You can work out a whole lot of great symbolic meaning using that little symbol of the cross. So you see, although it in a sense the cross itself had no natural symbolism as far as what we thought about it at the beginning. It does have a natural symbolism when we move from the event of the crucifixion into all the different ways in which that crucifixion involves us and involves the world. So you see, a symbol can look like an arbitrary symbol for a moment, and yet it isn't that, because it moves into the realm of so many relationships, and that's where something like the cross does, you know, that symbol of the cross, when it's moved into that kind of context, has a lot more than just meets the eye. You might say, now, there's a symbol, for instance, in mathematics, which goes like this, doesn't it? That kind of thing. Does that mean, yeah. What does that mean? Does that mean
greater than,
doesn't it? Okay, now, that's just that little, what's that called? Does that have a name?
Carrot.
Mm-hmm. Carrot. Anyway, it has that little odd, it looks like an angle, kind of in reverse. And now that's another, like, it's like that plus symbol. It's an arbitrary symbol. Now that means development. It means increasing or greater than. But that doesn't really give you, for instance, the growth of a tree, or it doesn't give you yeast in bread. I mean, that doesn't explain for you what those two symbols mean. Now, what growth means, or what rising means in a tree, or in leaven in a bread, or so on, that those two things are not that kind of symbol. When you say growth, and you say or you say leaven, or you say yeast, you can think of it in terms of so many different ways in which it means growth. But that little symbol of greater than, that doesn't have that kind of imaginative drawing power for you, so that, because it stays just within its own little category, and it's an arbitrary symbol again. But the minute you begin to use a natural symbol, like yeast or a seed or something like that, then you've got a lot of other things that can go on from it. Now, don't worry if this doesn't all make sense, because you'll see as we go along how this kind of thing is what makes up the fabric of imagination and of imaginative writing. And of all of our intercourse with each other, our communication with each other, is based on this kind of give and take in the form of natural symbols. Now, how many of you know what an allegory is? Do you know?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, go ahead, don't worry about it. But, I mean, there are so many people that have differing ideas on allegories, and they're very great and important people. So just go ahead and say it. Anything you like.
Just something you use to get across a point, you know, like an example sort of.
Like an illustration.
Yeah.
All right. Now how does an allegory how do you use an allegory if you're gonna really develop it? Can you think of a story, a book that is that you'd consider an allegory?
Well, I mean, Charles Williams is sent to hell.
Yes, in a sense, that's an allegory. Mm-hmm. Although he's more involved with using, from his terms, he would say he was using imagery rather than allegory, but in a broad sense.
The Great Divorce?
Yeah. That's a good one. Because the thing, there are, when I said that you can go ahead and say what you please about allegory, because of the fact that for instance, Dante calls his whole writing an allegory, and yet it's full of, really, of images. The way he uses it, it's an image-full kind of writing. And if you're going to be really tight on understanding the differences between allegory and imagery and image writing, you might say that allegory is like, how many of you know Pilgrim's Progress? Maybe you haven't all read it, maybe you have, but at least you know something about it. you know that all these big virtues and faults are personified as big either people or places, and they refer specifically to this particular person or place when you talk about it. For instance, despair in Pilgrim's Progress is symbolized by the giant Apollyon. He's a huge, huge, huge giant. And you might say, well, you know, why in the world would Bunyan have made a giant out of despair? Well, think about how terrible despair, if you've never been in despair, but if you have, you know, then you realize despair is a giant that absolutely is so huge that it engulfs your whole life, your whole vision. You can't even see out of his arms. He so crushes you. Or, for instance, he takes the slough of despond. Despond and despair are similar. That despair is a huge thing that crushes you. Despond is when you slip into a bog or quicksands that you can't get out, and you just push and push and you can't move, because that's how it is. Well, the thing is that with allegory, as Williams, for instance, explained it as different from images, he's very careful to show that you're never in any doubt what he's referring to. See, the slough of despond. Can't get mixed up with that. And furthermore, that slough of despond does not have a life of its own, separately or independently of the story itself. It's there particularly to remind you that that's what it's like to be in despond, to be a despondent person. The giant Apollyon doesn't have any life of his own except his life as a despair figure. He isn't a person in and of himself. Now, what you'll find in Dante, and you'll find this in the Narnia books, and you'll find it in the Williams books, all these people have lives of their own. They're images who have an independent life at the same time that they have a meaning that can be explored in maybe three different levels. So that you have a life of the one of the great qualities, for instance, of the Narnia books is that a lot of people don't even know they're about a Sunday school lesson. Thank God they don't. And Lewis said it was extremely important that these books be written so that they were purely entertaining and valuable and with a quality that didn't have to be apologized for on the basis of its being a so-called Christian writing. You know, well, of course, it's Christian, so of course we have to read it. You know, it's got to be good. I mean, that's not the way in which the images operate. An image has to have a good, solid, exciting life of its own. And then out of that life, it also has another ramification, and you have a lot of different interpretations. And you'll find this, we'll explain this a little bit more later, but that's what you get in the images, and that's why it's important to know about them. But with an allegory, as we understand it, more particularly with Pilgrim's Progress and so on, there it's a little bit, there's less left to your imagination. That is, it's much more explicit, it's much more defined, that this particular thing explains this particular virtue. This particular person is symbolizing this particular part of life. Mr. Worldly Wise, for instance, you know, in Pilgrim's Progress. Well, it's very obvious what he was, you know. And it's very obvious that Mr. Worldly Wise did not have a life of his own, because we don't have people of that name in an ordinary community. We may call them that, you know, in our private lives and private conversations. We think, well, you know what we could call him. But, you know, that's not his name. That's not his given name on his voter's record or anything, or his ID. But an allegory always points very specifically then to what it is referring. Now, an image is a symbol that is not a constructed thing. It's not something that's formed to prove something or to demonstrate something. An image is something that is discovered, and discovery is term in all the reading that you do in the Inklings and in the any of the really great writers, because this is what is the quality of eternity that I would say, at least, in really good writing of the imagination. You discover in an image, in the situation of the image as it's being enacted, the meanings that are beyond what are just there. Now, you know yourself that when, how many of you have ever read or heard of a writer who says, you might say, well, why, how's your story going to turn out? What's going to happen to that person? And the writer may say, well, I don't know yet because it isn't written yet. Well, surely you must have an idea of how it's going to be, how that story is going to turn out. You're writing it. Well, but no, I don't know. Because of the fact that that those people have a life of their own and they're operating. And you are, the writer is operating too, but somehow they develop. Now you're going to say that's crazy because, you know, I know very well that Dorothy Sayers knows, you know, she could have made Peter, what's his name, a Christian if she'd wanted to. She just didn't want to. You know, there are a lot of fundamentalist Christians that are upset because Peter Wimsey in the Dorothy Sayers detective stories is not a Christian. And she's a Christian. And why is one of her leading characters, her leading detective, why is he a Christian? I mean, just think what he could have done. I don't know if he would have been a better detective. Doubt it. But she said, I couldn't make him a Christian. He isn't a Christian. Okay, no. That's the thing about images. They have to operate. They operate on their own. And that's why they make a wonderful parallel with us as human beings. I mean, we operate on our own too. You know, and what happens to us depends on how we lead our lives and how we exercise our free will. But the interesting thing is that as you read a story where an image is really being discovered as having real meaning, that image will have several different interpretations of life that you can see into that particular situation. It isn't just the image. For instance, in The Descent into Hell, it isn't just what you see going on there of this problem. How many of you have read any of Williams' novels yet? Well, you know that almost all of Charles Williams, almost all of his plots have a very strong line of discovery in them, because you are continually aware that something is going on that you really can't put your fingers on. It's just a little bit beyond you. And they were beyond Williams. He admitted it. Very much so. But none of those stories demand that in order for credibility you be a Christian to read them, right? I mean, could you recommend them to somebody who's not a Christian? Well, how do you suppose those stories ever got sold? You think the Christians were buying them? Well, of course not. They're anything but propaganda. But when you are a Christian, what do you see in them? Or maybe you didn't. You may have to do some discussing on that next week. But I'm sure you did. I hate to sound like these patronizing teachers. You know, well, of course. I suppose you wouldn't have. Well, I'll enlighten you. it really used to just turn me off. And I used to think to myself, you know, if I hadn't already registered for this master's degree, I don't think I would have stayed with it, because some of those academics are really something else to deal with. And that's why when I get that kind of tone, I feel just like a minister that gets what the Norwegians used to call preketone, you know, and they get this kind of, you know, sort of, and you were supposed to feel a sense of inferiority just by the tone of the voice. And that's the way some teachers are, you know, they get a kind of a ponderousness about the way they talk. And I felt that just now when I was talking. I can't stand it. But anyway, the interesting thing about the images in Charles Williams and in in the Lewis books too, like Until We Have Faces, and in even in the Narnia books, you know, you're really not through with them either. And the Tolkien books, you really, nobody has got the last word on how those images are to be interpreted, because they belong to us. Those images do when we start reading them. There are properties too, because we bring something to the interpretation. And but what I was referring to when I said that about them being Christian, so called, is that it's the interpretation that you bring to them that gives them the depth of the particular angles that you personally are able to give to them. And so when you read them, that's what you're doing. You're discovering the meaning of not just the story itself, but you're discovering a whole another level of meaning that's in the life of the image itself, whether it's in the novel or whether it's in Dante or whether it's in a poem or whatever. There's something that Williams calls the identity of the image, and I think, although it sounds technical, I think it's important for you to at least be exposed to this, because I don't want you to think that imagery and the writing of, whether it's novels or poetry or whatever, in which you deal with images, that any kind of far-flown imagination, oh, that's imaginative writing. For Williams, the writing and development of images was an intellectual work. It's just as important and just as terrible to be inaccurate in image writing as it is to be inaccurate in mathematics. Now just remember that good writing is intellectually accurate. In fact, Williams used to say that hell was inaccurate and heaven was accurate. Now you might say, what's that mean? Well, it simply means that there's no place for sloppiness. If you're going to say you're thinking about something, then think clearly and don't say, well, but I've been a Christian, so I don't have to be so careful. I mean, that's just like one of Carol's favorite things is to say that, you know, that a person that's going to operate on you is apologizing for the fact that he can't do a very good job, but he is a Christian. he didn't go to class, but, you know, he skipped a few of the courses that he should have had, maybe, and maybe he cheated on his, but he became converted later and became a Christian. So you know, you do want to have a Christian doctor, don't you? You know, your father would never allow for that, I know. I mean, how we think that there are a double standard, one standard for Christians and one for the world, I don't know. We reverse them usually. But Williams is adamant on this, that if you're writing, and when you read good writing, you have a right to expect, and you also ought to use your head to sort out what's good and what's bad about it. So that when you read a book that is full of images, that you check out and find out whether or not that image is consistent. Is it a good image? Does it really have quality to it? Does it have the right relationship? Well, you might say, that's going to spoil all my reading. No, it isn't. The interesting thing is, that if you really believe in cultivating your mind and you want to know something, now this doesn't mean that everybody is going to do this, for goodness sakes. I mean, I'm not talking about this for just general consumption. I'm just simply saying that if you want to read with intelligence and with taste and with a sense of discrimination, then you have to apply your head to it. And you can't be taken in by a lot of junk. And that's what Williams is concerned about, because he feels Christians should not be taken in by junk. And that's what he means when he says heaven is accurate. It means that you don't, that doesn't mean you become a heavenly bookkeeper and check off what's good and what's bad and I've done this and I've done that. It's not in that area at all that he's referring to it. But what he's saying is that you don't allow yourself to just be carried away by a lot of cheap literature that really doesn't give you the kind of depth that real writing does. Now, these are the things that he says are important in terms of understanding what makes a good image. For one thing, it has to have a clear identity with its basis. Now, when I say basis, I mean, what is the image referring to? The first thing you have to think about when you think about an image is that it has an identity with itself. Now, we talked about that at the beginning, and I've been referring to it because this is, a primary quality to remember. The image has an identity independently. It has a life of its own. Two, individual identity, the identity of the image might be two images, two identities that may have a similar feature. They may have something that they share, but still be two different things. So you, just because an image has an identity of its own doesn't mean that there can't be something similar with something else. I mean, two girls can have some similarities, but you know that they are two different people. They may wear their hair the same way, but it's not the same hair. They may talk about the same thing, but they don't speak about it the same way. This is true also of images. For instance, the one that I used before, for example, in terms of the cross, you know, the crossroad idea. You have a crossroad is an image that has of the road itself making a crossroad, and then you have the crossroad in terms of a man standing at a crossroad and trying to decide which road to go on. In terms of not just physically, but in terms of a life decision, so that it becomes a symbol of a life. So that there is a similarity in that image, not just in its externality, that they both are crossroads. I'm at the crossroads of decision, I'm at the crossroads to decide, should I go here to go to Seattle, or should I go that way? Which way is the right way? I mean, it could be either. But the thing is that they do have similarities, and yet they have independent lives of their own. You see, one of them, it can be a crossroad physically, it can be a crossroad spiritually. In other words, that the differences are important. The fact that there's a difference there is just as important as the fact that it's similar. So that you have a category of an identity in which you have the decision to make a life choice at this particular crossroad in your life, or you have a decision to go to one city by this road or that road, deciding which one is better. They have similarities, but they are ultimately different. You see what I mean? They are ultimately different because it's not that crucial whether you decide to go to Seattle this way, take this pass or that pass. You can go Stevens or Blewett. But it may be very crucial in that crossroads situation whether you decide to go into medicine or music. That may make a very big difference to you, you see? So that there's quite a difference in the ultimate decision, although the similarities are there in terms of the decision making. The differences are also radical, are much more radical rather, because of the fact that the end result of that decision is a life change. The third thing that you have to remember, you should remember about images, is that what the image refers to is always greater than the image itself. That is the big meaning of the image. Now, the reason for this is that otherwise you can get lost in simply the image going along and moving and getting excited about what's going on with a story or a character or a situation. But if you are applying your head to this so that it becomes a real intellectual exercise for you, you do look for something beyond it. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to sit down and read every book that you read. Like, for instance, when you read Charles Williams, that you say, oh, there must be a meaning here. There's a meaning here. There's a meaning here. I've got to look for the meaning. Now, that's not the way to read any book if you're going to enjoy it. You're going to have to pull it apart the minute you start reading it. But as you read him, the more you read him, the more his style becomes available to you so that you begin to read on more than one level at once. You read it as a story, as an exciting thing happening. Sometimes you have to go back and read it over again to get the second meaning. Gradually, as you become, as I say, accustomed to him and accustomed to his style, then you begin to grab these meanings at different levels. This is also true at, to some extent, with Dante, as we'll see tomorrow when we talk about him. But it isn't all that clear, because our understanding of the politics of Florence isn't very real to most of us. So that many of his allusions are not actual to us. But that doesn't matter, because actually the basic part of the Dante writing is so exciting and so beautiful that you don't have to know the political background and that kind of level in order to understand his imagery. There are some things to think about in terms of the difference between, I'd say philosophically, between allegory and imagery and images, simply just for your own understanding of why there's a difference in using of terms. And I'm just going to quickly give this to you because I see it's getting hard.
Mary?
Yeah?
Could you, on the clear identity with its basis, the first point of doing this, could you talk a little bit about that more? A good image, a clear, first thing, a clear...
Yeah, I can bring that up in this next section a little bit, but the important thing is that there is, and when I said that there's an identity of the image with its basis, that means that there is a real relationship between the image that you're using or that you discover and the general truth or idea that you're trying to demonstrate. In other words, an image does not uncover a truth for you that is completely foreign to the truth itself. There is a relationship that is possible to sense and understand between the image that's used, and I'll say illustration, although I don't like that word because it gives you a different feeling. But the actual person that embodies the truth that you're talking about has a relationship with the truth or the idea that you're explaining. Now, I was trying to think of something that you knew. For example, in one of the Williams books, how many of you read Many Dimensions? Any of you read that, the one about the stone? Well, that's such a neat one. It's really a good one. I was just thinking about that one because it has a kind of a good... Well, anyway, there's a stone that is discovered in... It belongs... It's especially good because of all the Arabian oil stuff, and we're seeing the Arabs so much more now. about a Far Eastern... potentate that had a Middle Eastern potentate that had a crown, and there was a big stone in it, and it was sort of the stone from that had a history of almost since creation. It had a quality of power in it that gave it, if you had the stone, you know, you could move from here to Koinonia and you know, you wouldn't even see me go, and I'd be down there, you know, or in the dining room or into Chelan. You know, that's the way, that's the kind of power it had. It also had the power to do, to stop time. It had the power to do a lot of things, very magical. Well, of course, who's going to get control of the stone is this big problem in this many
dimensions, in this novel.
The stone is a very specific kind of power. It's used in a lot of different ways in that book, in Many Dimensions. Williams uses it in terms of its relationship with a lot of different people. One of the characters in the story is a young secretary who is a sort of a Christ figure.
And her relationship with the stone is one of love and devotion. She really loves the stone. She feels that it has a quality that should not be exploited. And so when she could have used it to you know, magic her away from a problem, she doesn't, because she refuses to exploit it. She allows herself to be open to a very, very dreadful situation in which she suffers a great deal, because she will not exploit the stone. The stone is used in many ways, and what they want to use it for making money for their aero. The British want to use it to make a new kind of airplane thing out of it. Somebody else wants to get rid of it because it's going to threaten all their plane services, because if they can manufacture it, you know, my goodness, we could all have our little stones anywhere, and we wouldn't be dependent on Boeing or anybody else. And in Britain, of course, that time they have their own name for it. Well, now this is an image. This image always refers to a certain kind of power that is concentrated in one particular kind of a form. Williams never uses it, for example, as an image of the city of God, for example. This is a stone. This is a power image. This is something that people could use, but it's not a community thing. It's not a big city idea or anything like that, or the kingdom of God. It's definitely not that. It's never used as that. Now, by that I'm saying that for instance, that image, all is faithful, the way Williams uses it, it's faithful to its basis. That is, he doesn't use something that is just not at all like, or would not connect with what he's talking about. In other words, he uses the stone as a symbol of power, as an image of power in a lot of different areas. But it's not used, for instance, as a good life, or as an example of Jesus Christ doing, you know, deciding between good and evil or anything like that. It's simply a power thing. There's none of the value judgments in it at all. You see, that for instance, if it was a person he was using, then that person as an image is another thing again. And some of the people in the book are images, and they relate to a different kind of truth. But the stone I'm using simply because it's so obvious that it does not, he keeps the identity of that stone related to its basis or to what it's referring, so that you're not mixed up or confused that it's got, you've got to
think beyond it, you know, in order to understand it. It really has a relationship. And Williams says this is what he means by accuracy. You don't just use any old thing. I mean, any old image will work.
And Williams says this is what he means by accuracy. You don't just use any old thing. I mean, any old image will work. That's a lot of... I'm not going to say what I think it is, because I sometimes think of, and I read too many bad books and hear too much bad language, and then I'm inclined to use something like that when I think something is really bad, and then find out that it's on tape afterwards.
that's to do with the accuracy of the identity of the image and its basis, that there has to be, it can't be completely incongruous, in other words. It's got to be some real precision in terms of relationships. And yet, philosophically, the whole problem with the image is just like it is the problem of faith and the Christian life. It's a risk. Now, if you want to be absolutely sure
that people are going to know what you're talking about. No, no misinterpretations. Use allegory that is strictly interpreted. In other words, you get a similarity between, you say, this person is symbolizing this thing. Mr. Worldly Wise Man, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Worldly wise. We know what we think about worldly wise people. And you know that that's the way he's acting, and you know that that's the way it will be if you let yourself in on that kind of thing. Okay. If you look at Pilgrim's Progress and look at that, just go down in the library or in the bookstore and look at that character list. And you'll see all those people. They all refer specifically to a particular virtue or fault in life as we know it morally. All right, or religiously. All right, now just remember that that is a strictly interpreted allegory. That's a strictly interpreted allegory. It's extremely precise. You move from the general to the particular. You go from the idea to the symbol. You go from heaven to earth, you might say. It's always that you have this clear picture of what it is you're talking about. Nobody can be in any doubt. It's always precise. It's always controlled and maneuvered. And actually, if you're going to deal philosophically with some truth, the best thing to do is use this allegory. What did Jesus use?
Parables.
Parables. What are they? Are they allegories? No, they aren't, are they? They're more like images, aren't they? How many, my goodness, what would we have done for sermon material if they'd been allegories? We would have been through, you know. But now, you know, we can do the prodigal son, and we can do the father, and we can do the elder brother. We can even do the gold ring if we need to. We could just go through the whole thing. There's so many things to discuss. And it's not all clear. It took a long time before people suddenly realized it was the father that was being talked about and not the prodigal son's repentance. I mean, for a lot of people, it's the prodigal son's repentance is still the most important because that's where we're at, most of us. But, you know, this is the great thing about the image. But, you know, Jesus was risky. You know, he didn't figure that you had to, you know, now this is a pattern of this and this is a pattern of that, the way that some of the other writers of the New Testament did. He really just threw it out and said, look, there's a gal that lost her wedding silver. She lost one coin of it. She's looking all over for it. And you think, what's that got to do with it? You know, okay, now what's the basis of that? What is the basis in that, if, as Williams would say, what is it that Jesus is talking about in this lost coin? The coin is lost, and the basis is our relationship with the Father. That he's, you know, if we're lost, we're not, you know, he's not going to be satisfied till we're found. And then what happens afterwards? You remember in that parable? What'd she do?
She rejoices.
Yeah, she rejoiced. She told her friends, you know, wow, I found my contact lens. You know? Real excitement. And that makes a difference, you know? When you realize that there is a relationship here between what's happening in both stories is parallel. You see, they're not incongruous at all. The lost sheep is the same way. It is the same way. Jesus is just full of them, you know, way ahead of the inklings. Funny, too. Isn't it? Strange. How really on the ball Jesus is. Well, the point is that this is the problem with imagery, is that you don't control it. I said before, it has a life of its own. It has an independence. It has an identity.
okay, it's going to operate. So then, when people look at the parables of Jesus, yeah, they're great literary gems, really great literary gems. I mean, people can read them and not be affected by them. And Jesus took the chance. You know, he said, okay, you know, I'm just telling you. And the disciples said, well, can't you explain this to us? We don't understand what you're talking about. Come on, tell us. Well, you know, I still believe, as Blake did, that God expected every man to be a thinker. He made us not to be lazy, but to think. And you don't think, you don't have to think with great big hunks of abstractions and philosophical truths. I mean, the parables require you to think. Only the trouble is that the preachers have taken care of explaining everything so that we don't think anymore about them, you know? They don't digest for us. And we just sit and listen to it and go, yeah, that's wonderful. And then we sort of semi-wake up and go home. But actually, the parables, you know, we can actually, you know, absorb them ourselves if we just sit down and you know, clear our minds a little bit and operate with them as images and try to figure out what their identity and what their basis is. Analyze them a little bit. Won't hurt. Doesn't hurt scripture. Doesn't deny the inspiration. Just makes it more interesting. The image speaks to an existential situation. It means that you and I are caught what an old Latin phrase that was always a description of the way ethics were supposed to start, in medias res, in the middle of things. We're caught in the middle of things, in the middle of life, having to make a decision. And the image speaks out of this kind of situation, in the middle of things. It isn't a setup. It isn't carefully worked out ahead of time. It's much more like the Socratic dialogues are, which are inductive. You know what inductive reasoning is? You know, you lead it out of people, that you make them think it through. You pull it out of them by questions and answers. Well, in a sense, the image person, the person who's doing the images, is doing that for you. He's making you do your own thinking, making you experience the situation, making you go through it. Now, this has a lot to do with why you read literature, why you read novels if you don't. And I said if you don't, because, you know, that's why you don't. Because it requires a real leap of faith to read a novel. Requires a lot of drop off in terms of yourself in order to project into a novel. And yet you really need to do this in order to, I think, in order to live. And I think I've cut off a lot of my ears and nose and lots of things because I haven't read novels very much because I'm so busy being so purposive and learning so many important things. And really, it's like C.S. Lewis says, you don't learn to know people by studying them. You learn to know them by knowing them. And when you read a novel, or you read literature, or read whatever that where you get into this kind of imagery kind of situation, you're caught in with people so that they react on you, and something happens to you. You don't construct it; it happens to you. And that's where imagery is such an exciting way of writing. Why it's an exciting kind of reading to do. And why we call it this Christian imagination is the work of people who deal in images, because they believe firmly in the image of God, in the fact that an image has a life of its own, so that the novel or the poem has an exciting line of thought and plot and development all by itself, at the same time that it has an eternal dimension. It may have a political dimension. It may have a lot of other dimensions. So that it's not just a flat land that you're going through, but it's incarnate. You can feel it. It's got flesh and blood. It's got history. It's got future. It's got everything. And this is what makes this kind of reading exciting. But you have to use your heads. You know, you just can't do it going to sleep. It's not like looking at TV. You know, it just isn't. It's not a, and it's not a demonstrated mathematical problem. It requires an involvement of yourself in that situation of the reading. And that's why it just speaks to everything in you, and why it's important that you allow this to happen. Now, this is a matter of choice. You don't have to read this way. Nobody's going to force it on you. This is simply a choice, just like everything else is in life. And you can, you know, you can just go right along and read digests of books and be satisfied with being able to make conversation about this or that and say, oh, yes, I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, that was where he said this. Uh-huh. And you know very well, you know, you haven't been involved in that character or that book. But you've made a good impression, and that's all right. That's all you care about. But if you really care about living, you really want to get into something, and don't worry if you haven't read so many things. Read a couple things and really get involved in them and let them happen to you. And that's what the images do. They really happen to you if you let them. But if you're busy trying to just, of course, this is a terrible time to tell you this, when you're trying to get through reading a whole lot of stuff that you've put aside and, you know, pushed away. And I'll tell you about what happens in purgatory to the people that, you know, put things aside. They did get saved, but boy, they had a rough time. It's just like in Gilbert and Sullivan, the punishment fits the crime, the punishment fits the crime. And in purgatory, Dante really takes the people through that were preoccupied. They have to spend just as long a time going around these terrible areas and on the Mount of Purgatory as they spent putting off the decision to repent. You see, the punishment fits the crime. A long time they spent in purgatory. No wonder they asked for prayers by the faithful and, you know, at the church at home. Of course, we're not Catholic, so we don't have to worry about it. That's just too bad for them. Well, anyway, I just want you to realize that this business of understanding and reading books that have to do with the image and the whole understanding of imagery is something that's exciting and requires energy. It requires intellectual energy. You know, we often think about energy as being physical. Something, I don't have the energy to get up the hill anymore, or I just don't have the energy to do that. Well, you know, it takes a lot of energy just to sit down and read a book, and you know that, don't you? And it takes even more energy to stay awake while you're reading it. If you're going to, I'm not talking about this with the idea that this is what everybody knows and everybody does, because everybody doesn't. This is a quality of reading that is has a hallmark of its own, has a distinctive kind of way of doing it, and it does require some work on your part. And it's very hard, I think, for all of us in these days to concentrate, because we have so many stimulations coming from so many different places. And I'm not talking about Holden, I'm just talking about all of us in our century. And you do have to learn how to discipline yourself away from some of those stimuli in order to read this way. And that's one of the hardest things that any of us has to do. But if you really want to find out what in-depth reading is like, then I could unqualifiedly recommend this. And I would like to just close with this thought that William says, and I think this is just really good. Well, he says, that the first law of the spiritual life, that hell is always inaccurate and heaven is always exact. And the standards a definition. How do you keep an image from simply going, being just the result of a far-fetched imagination gone wild? You do by exercising your intelligence, your reason, examining the assumptions, and testing the implications of that image. And that's what we were doing when we were talking about the parables of Jesus. Isn't it good that he came out on top? We can say hurrah for him, our leader won. Well, you know, it is a good thing that since he is our original, isn't it a great thing that, you know, you never have to worry. You can light anything up, and I don't know if you always like to be on the winning team, but that's one thing I used to love about reading the Socratic dialogues, because Socrates always won. And I'd always think, oh, he's gonna beat him again. I think David Swenson thought I was crazy, but I said, I just love to be on the winning team every time, and I know he's gonna come out there. Have you read, I don't know if you've read any of Plato, but he's really fun. The early dialogues are not hard. I don't know why they throw the Republic and the laws and stuff like that on kids. You know, they could really learn a lot about thinking if they'd read the early dialogues, which are just question and answers, and they really teach you a lot. But it is a wonderful thing to know that when you read the scriptures, that it really comes out with a lot of the kind of things that we talk about in very learned groups like this. You know, and you find the scriptures are already there. That's really fun to know. Well, that's just part of it. Anyway, I did want I'm just going to read quickly a couple of things and then close with this wonderful little statement that I think he makes. Any image has some intrinsic limits. It is its own proper nature. It represents the greater, but it can't represent something counter to it. Now, I was very careful to explain that in relationship to the basis, the idea that it doesn't do something absolutely different. The image doesn't do something different from the kind of thing that you're trying to explain. Second, the way you check it out is whether the frame of reference within the author's writing, what is the author writing about in general, that you feel that this image actually intensifies and illuminates it, makes it clearer. That's when you can tell whether the image is doing a good job. Do you really get the feeling from the image that you suddenly get a new opening on what the author is saying? And then it's a good thing to notice with a great deal of care to see the differences that lie between the image and the basis or what it's referring to. That it's not an identical thing. It's not an allegory that's completely controlled so that you know for sure what's being talked about, but that there is a variation. And that's where I say, like with Jesus and the parables, there's a lot of risk. Because they're not identical. You know yourself that God isn't somebody looking for contact lenses. But there's a relationship, but there's a difference. And like the French say, you know, that's what you really have to celebrate is the difference. And this is something you have to be aware of when you read these stories, and you don't try to make them patterns of so that they're identical, but that they have that each has its own differences and it's perfectly valid. I think this is important because of the fact, the reason I want to end with this is that it's important because when one of the statements that Charles Williams makes all through his writings is a very cryptic little thing that came from one of the early writings of the Christian church. This also is thou. Neither is this thou. This also is thou. Neither is this thou. Now, he's talking about God. He's saying, this is thou. This is also thou. Neither is this thou. You see what I mean?
No, I don't.
Okay, good. I'm very glad if somebody speak up. The Bible. This is thou. Neither is this thou. Now, do you get that?
Yes, I get that.
Okay. Even the sacrament. This is thou. This is also thou. Neither is this thou. Now, do you see what we're getting at? We don't have God in our pockets. We simply can't say we've got him all tied up so we know exactly where he is all the time. No, we just don't have him there. It's not a stone we can put in our pockets and use. But there is an identity, there's a recognition of him in a lot of different places. But the important thing...